This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The five mighty Great Lakes, separated from the ocean for millennia, hold 20% of the world's surface freshwater. Dreams of trade spurred construction of the St. Lawrence Seaway, opening the lakes to intercontinental shipping, but transforming their ecosystems thanks to unintended biological hitchhikers like the quagga and the zebra zep mussels are still a problem. And environmental journalist Dan Egan's new book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, details the changes as he discussed the impact on the Great Lakes with Living on Earth host Steve Curwood.
On April 24, 1959, this was the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
270 years ago, fur traders and missionaries hacked their way through the forests of New France. They were looking for an easy way into the Great Lakes and a way to bring lake ships around the rapids to the sea. They completed a 2,000-yard ditch. Then, one August night, the Iroquois massacred the building party. But they had started. Yesterday, the St. Lawrence Seaway was open.
The opening of the links from the Great Lakes to the sea along the U.S.-Canadian border was the fulfillment of a dream and vision for the heartland of the continent that environmental journalist Dan Egan details in his new book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes.
The whole idea behind the St. Lawrence Seaway was to essentially carve an American Mediterranean out of the middle of the continent by basically blasting a shipping channel between the Great Lakes and the Atlantic Ocean. The Great Lakes collectively span 94,000 square miles, which is basically the size of the UK, but in a lot of ways they were as isolated as a pond in the middle of the woods because there was no way anything from the ocean or from the eastern seaboard could get up into the lakes because of Niagara Falls and, for Lake Ontario, the roaring, tumbling St. Lawrence River. And then on the western side, there was what they call a subcontinental divide, which basically was a ridgeline that separated the Great Lakes waters from those of the Mississippi River Basin.
Really, Dan, one of the things that's fascinating about your book is you say that when the St. Lawrence Seaway was built, it was already obsolete practically on the day that it opened. Why didn't it become the trade highway that its builders envisioned, do you think?
A couple of reasons. One, they built it on the cheap. They built it to match some existing locks that bypass Niagara Falls. It's known as the Welland Canal. And those locks were built in the 1930s. So there was no sense in building along the St. Lawrence River a whole new set of locks that were much larger because the boats would have hit a bottleneck at the Welland Canal. And they weren't about to rebuild the Welland Canal because it was going to double the cost of the project. So they built it on the cheap, and the size of the locks and the channels really reflected the size of the world's fleet in the 1930s, not in the late 1950s or early 1960s. And there was another reason, too, and that's ice. You know, you can't have a world-class shipping corridor that shuts down for 3 months of the year. Otherwise, you know, the car plants aren't going to get their clutches or whatever they need. I mean, in this world of just-in-time delivery, you need fast, dependable, predictable, perennial deliveries, and you just can't do that with a navigation route that is choked by ice. So what we're left here is really kind of a boutique shipping industry. The boats, while huge on a human scale, are not very big on the grand scale of today's modern fleet. Maybe 5% of the world's cargo carrying capacity can fit in the locks. And so what happened was the Seaway opens in 1959 and the container revolution took off almost simultaneously. And that demanded bigger and bigger boats. So the Seaway got squeezed aside. So what we have today is a system where a limited number of ships, on average, it's been fewer than two per day during the 9 month shipping season, come in up the St. Lawrence Seaway from overseas and deliver their cargo to Great Lakes ports. And their cargo is not high-value goods like Nikes and Sonys and Toyotas. It's primarily bulk goods, largely steel, which we know how to build steel here. And outbound is grain. They take grain off the plains and move it to the western Great Lakes ports and put it on boats and take it all over the world.
But even if the link the St. Lawrence Seaway provided to the rest of the world was not the huge commercial success hoped for, it did bring in plenty of life. though it was the wrong kind. Invasive species from alewives to zebra mussels hitched rides in ballast tanks of ocean freighters. And as the agricultural center of North America flourished, with increasing pesticide and nutrient runoff from corn and wheat fields into the Great Lakes, author Dan Egan says the consequences of the biological pollution became clear.
It's really a number of organisms working in concert. I'll give you an idea of how dangerous this biological pollution can be. Zebra and quagga mussels, tiny little mollusks that invaded the Great Lakes from the Caspian Sea basin, now blanket the bottom of the Great Lakes. If I were to walk from Milwaukee, the 80 or 90 miles across the lake to Muskegon, Michigan, I could do the whole trip basically on a bed of quagga mussels. So why is that dangerous? If you look at what happened to Lake Erie in 2014, in late August, I believe, 500,000 people lost their drinking water. And they lost their drinking water because there was an outbreak of a toxic algae called Microcystis, which produces a toxin called microcystin. That's naturally occurring in the Great Lakes. But these mussels basically eat everything but that algae, so that algae has no competition. So when the conditions set up, in western Lake Erie, for example, there's a lot of phosphorus going into the lake because that's big corn country on the western end of Lake Erie. So you get the temperatures and the fertilizer and the water conditions for an algae bloom, and where 50 years ago it might have been a whole array of different types of organisms, now it's pretty much a microcystis show. So it's a pollutant, you know, just as toxic and dangerous and problematic as anything that can come out of an industrial pipe or smokestack.
So what's the solution? How do you get rid of these invasive species, these mussels that cause so much trouble?
Well, that's the problem. You don't. I mean, and that's the difference between this traditional sense of pollution where you can, you know, cap a smokestack or plug a pipe, but this doesn't decay or disperse this biological pollution. It breeds. It doesn't mean that Lake Erie's water is going to be poisonous from here on out every late summer. There are other things we can do. Specifically, we can reduce the amount of phosphorus going into the lake, but the mussels are here, and we're really going to just have to learn to live with them.
Now, there's another significant water passageway that you focus on, and that's the Chicago Canal, which was originally built to bridge the divide between the Great Lakes and the Mississippi. Why was this canal constructed, and why is it a problem? Why is the Army Corps of Engineers now looking at ways to block it up?
Well, like the St. Lawrence Seaway, the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal was a good idea at the time. And so it opened in 1900, and it was built because the booming city of Chicago was basically dumping its raw sewage into the Chicago River. The river flowed into Lake Michigan, and that's where the city's drinking water intakes were. So Chicagoans were basically drinking their own filth. And the crude but somewhat elegant solution was to reverse the river. And suddenly we have a river flowing out of Lake Michigan instead of into Lake Michigan, and it solved Chicago's drinking water problems. But the consequences of doing this are now coming into focus for a number of reasons, not the least of which are these super carp known as Asian carp that have infested the Mississippi River basin. They're kind of like mini baleen whales, but they're not that mini. They can grow to over 100 pounds and eat up to 20% of their weight in plankton a day, and are moving their way up the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal toward Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes.
So overall, invasive species have cost folks around the Great Lakes a lot. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe billions of dollars. And as you point out, the Midwest is still doing a lot more trade via railways from East Coast harbors than from ships in their own ports. So I'm scratching my head. Why do these lake economies continue to keep their harbors open to the risk of foreign vessels?
Well, that's a good question. And I want to be clear that the Seaway and Great Lakes shipping, it is an important navigation corridor, but the vast majority of goods moved along the Seaway and on the Great Lakes are moved by local boats, but not by overseas freighters. And these aren't the boats that are bringing in invasive species. The overseas industry is a tiny component of the big picture. It's maybe 5% of the cargo moved by tonnage, and it's the equivalent of roughly two boats a day coming into the Seaway during the nine-month shipping season. So it's not a big industry, but it is an important one to the people who own the boats and to the port operators, and they've been very active in making sure that it continues to operate as it has historically. I should note they've taken steps to address this ballast issue, some big, important, and effective steps to require boats coming into the lakes to flush their ballast tanks mid-ocean with salt water, the idea being that it will expel or kill any freshwater hitchhikers. But the science shows that this saltwater flush, though it goes a long way to reducing the threat, it by no means eliminates it.
So if it were up to you, would you close off the St. Lawrence Seaway, say, yeah, you're not really moving enough international boats to make it worthwhile?
I'll say this. I think it should be put on the table. I think there should be a cost-benefit analysis done and look at, you know, what is the economic benefit we're getting from these relatively few ships coming up the Seaway compared to the ecological and economic impacts that these invasive species have had, not just on the Great Lakes, but across the continent, because it turns out that invasions that start in the Great Lakes often go national, and this is why they are chasing zebra and quagga mussels all across the Northwest and doing everything they can to keep them out of the Columbia River drainage.
Well, wait, how do zebra mussels get west if these systems aren't touching, if they're not physically connected?
So, I mean, I like to think of it as that there's a front door and a back door. The front door is the St. Lawrence Seaway, and the back door is the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. So species that make their way in through the front door often go out the back door. Zebra mussels, quagga mussels, can just ride currents into the Mississippi River Basin, and from there it's off to the races. When you think about the number of reservoirs and boat ramps and boats out west, and the idea that these people are drawing a line around each water body, doing everything they can to stop a contaminated boat from contaminating the next pond, lake, or reservoir, it's almost an impossible task. Then if you go across the continent and you look at the boats that have brought in this trouble, every single one of them has to go through this exquisitely tight pinch point. It's called the St. Lambert Lock. It's the first lock on the St. Lawrence Seaway, and it's 80 feet wide. If you stop trouble there, you save a continent's worth of trouble.
What happens as we go further into this era of human-induced climate disruption, where water is highly variable, where we're going to have a lot of refugees from other parts of America? I'm guessing a lot of these folks are going to head to the Great Lakes, where in a warmer world, there's still plenty of water. So a lot of folks, they need someplace to come. And if it's flooded in the coastal areas and if it's dry in the west.
Hey, Milwaukee's great. You know, the Rust Belt could become the Blue Belt. I think that it's easier for people to move to wet places than for water to move to dry places. The big threat is not people using water along the edge of the lakes. It's people taking water out of the basin. Because once you take even one drop out of the Great Lakes basin, it doesn't flow back down into the Great Lakes. It flows somewhere else and it's gone. And enough of those drops and you get to see the lakes start to shrink.
Your book is wide-ranging, enjoyably written, and scary in a lot of spots. But as you get towards the end, you do offer up some glimmers of hope.
Well, one of the neat things that I think is happening is the lakes are starting to reach some sort of new balance. Zebra and quagga mussels made it a lake that is not reflective of what it was historically in terms of algae, which is the foundation of the food chain. For years and years, that algae just hit a nutritional dead end when it was sucked up by the mussels because nothing could eat the mussels. Well, another wave of invaders came through, and that's the round gobies. And they're little bug-eyed fish about the size of your thumb. And they are evolutionarily built to eat zebra and quagga mussels because they came from the same place, the Caspian Sea Basin. And they came the same way in the ballast tanks of overseas freighters sailing up the Seaway. So the gobies can eat mussels. And mussels are an unlimited energy supply if you can crack those shells and get at them. And the gobies can do that. So anything that can eat gobies, native species like lake trout, whitefish, walleye, are really starting to surge. And they're doing it on the backs of these invasive species. So the bottom of the food chain looks completely different, but the top is starting to put itself together and looks more like it did 100 years ago than any time in recent history. There's a balance that seems to be emerging, which is encouraging. You say that it's a scary story, and it is, and it's a depressing story, and it is to a degree. But nature's, you know, obviously resilient, and there are signs that things are getting better for the Great Lakes. I just hope that we continue to move in that direction because, you know, healthy fish and clean water and pleasant beaches, that's not a partisan thing. That's just something that everybody likes and should actually demand.
Dan Egan's book is called Death and Life of the Great Lakes. Dan, thanks so much for taking the time with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Living on Earth is a public radio program that comes from the School of for the Environment at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. And you can find out more about the program online at www.loe.org. Whiting City officials are working on a nationwide marketing approach to its Mascot Hall of Fame that's now under construction. I recently went to Mayor Joe Stahura's office to find out the latest on the project and some other projects that are underway in his city. Mayor Stahura, give us an update on the Mascot Hall of Fame, how the project is coming along, as well as the efforts to come up with the funding, because you want to have enough money to be able to get everything done, have this place open and ready to go when it's finally built.
The Mascot Hall of Fame project is moving along really well right now. The construction is in full gear. The building is going up in front of our eyes and probably be totally enclosed here within a matter of a couple weeks. The building's paid for, so that's the good news. But what we're doing right now is we're entertaining a fundraising period to raise the funds for the internal exhibits. That's the bells and whistles where the kids that come to the Hall of Fame will actually interact with and enjoy. And a lot of people don't realize this, but the Mascot Hall of Fame is really a children's museum with a mascot theme. So if people have that question, and I do get it a lot, it's all about making sure the kids have fun. But it's going well. Fundraising is a little slower than I like it right now, but we've got a lot of participation from some of the professional sports teams. We're working on several more, and I'm on the road right now talking to corporations and local businesses.
I was going to think that it was probably more of a national marketing project than anything else right now, because if the building's going up and you don't have to worry about raising the funds for the building itself, mm-hmm. you've just got, the inside of the building to take care of.
That's right. You're right. And it is a national effort. We have a professional marketing, sports marketing team working out there in a national market right now, and they're actually contacting corporations who have an interest in participating and helping us. But one of the hangups is that we really need to get some local participation. So, all the national people, the first question they ask is who locally is supporting the project. And right now, BP's been a great partner with us. Of course, their tax dollars are helping fund the building. They've lent their help and assistance to the project in all the ways they can. But right now, I'm still looking for some local dollars so that we hopefully can get a partner here locally and make that work.
Okay. When you're looking for partners locally, what organizations or businesses or industries besides BP are you looking for?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't want to leave anybody out, but we're looking for sponsors all the way from the number one sponsor, which would be the presenting sponsor, which really would be the company that has their name on the building. So Mascot Hall of Fame presented by, maybe a local bank or a local industry will help step up to help us with that. Some of the lower tier sponsorships where they'll sponsor exhibits inside the hall or external components of the building, we have made a lot of progress on those, really looking for that top guy and then anything else that we could help, along the way. But again, I think the importance of having an Indiana or a local sponsor is what we're really searching for right now.
Besides the Mascot Hall of Fame, I know that there are a lot of other projects that are underway besides the usual ones like Pierogi Fest. And also now, too, I guess I've got the History Channel interested in shooting some tape, so to speak, in Whiting this next month. Tell us what that business is going to be all about and what the public can enjoy if they come here as well during that time.
Sure. Well, anybody that's familiar with Whiting knows we have a cruise night every summer. It's the third Wednesday of every month, and we usually have a special Hollywood cruise night in the middle of the summer that attracts thousands of people. The cars that we get for the Hollywood night cruise night are from a museum up in Volo, Illinois. It's the Volo Car Museum, and we've partnered with Volo on numerous projects, our 4th of July parades, the cruise nights. We've bought some vehicles for our museum from them. So an opportunity arose to Volo actually is working with the History Channel to shoot an entire season series for called Volo House of Cars. And what they're doing is showcasing all of their Hollywood cars, all their operation, all the people and famous people who have bought their vehicles over time. So they're going to come into Whiting on the third Thursday of May, which is May 17th, I believe. Yes. May 17th. Right. And on May 17th, they're going to shoot an episode here mainly about whiting. So a lot of people on the street, you come on down, maybe you can get your head in a shot and be on History Channel for a couple episodes.
I was wondering what the producers had let you know ahead of time what they wanted to really look for when they come into town on the 17th.
Yeah, what they're going to do is they're going to have a script, and the script is going to be to tell a story about the Volvo cars. So they'll be shooting some scenes of the cars that we have purchased from them, some of the cars that they bring into town. The main theme will be about the Disney bus, the history of the Disney bus. They're going to actually bring that vehicle down to Whiting for the cruise night, and that'll be the feature component of their show. But in the meantime, they're going to get some footage of downtown Whiting, maybe grab a shot at the Mascot Hall of Fame, and it'll be a good promotional video or episode for the city.
Have these folks from the History Channel, maybe another production team, come into Whiting before, maybe for like Pierogi Fest or something like that?
We've got a lot of people from national media. The History Channel, probably this will be their first chance, our first time. But we have worked with them before, and we have discussed opportunities to do some local history shots in the future. I'll say that more than likely they'll be around again sometime down the road.
I'm going to say, if they haven't come to Pierogi Fest, they have to come back, even if they only come back and shoot some scenes of what's going on here. Then they have to be here to catch the pageantry and the crowds when they come into historic downtown Whiting to take a look at all the feast and everything that's going on. So.
Yeah, it'd be a great time for them to come down, but of course they run series that have some sort of a script or some kind of a theme, and somehow we'll have to figure out a way maybe of local festivals or something where we can get them back in town to shoot that, but they'd be great.
When you talk about all the projects going on here, we just touched on a few here with the Mascot Hall of Fame and Volvo coming in here with their cars for cruise night and the opportunity to be on national cable TV in that respect. What else does the city of Whiting work on as far as these regular events to be able to market the community? Because being one of the, if not the smallest Lake County community that has such a presence in the market.
Yeah, we have a great marketing staff, and we really get a good play, and a lot of people come to Whiting for our summer events. You know, our real challenge is to try to find people in the cool weather months to get to town. But this summer, again, we have a jam-packed the schedule full of events. We'll have the jet ski races back in Whiting. We're going to have a new water aqua park set up at Wahala Beach this year that will actually allow people to go out there and enjoy themselves on inflatable slides and trampolines out in the water. It'll be a fee-based operation, but it should be a lot of fun. Come on down and enjoy yourself after we get it set up. And again, we always we got the 4th of July parade, which is going to be the longest running parade in the state. We have a back to school night. We're going to have probably an induction ceremony for the Mascot Hall of Fame coming up. Probably push that into next year though. So never short of events. So we're always looking to bring people to town, entertain them.
Well, not only to bring them to town for events too, but we know that there always been efforts here, and especially in recent years for economic development to bring new businesses in. Mm-hmm. The ideas, of course, of a nice hotel and more restaurants in Whiting has got to be worked on there. What's the latest on that project?
It's a project with a lot of legs still. We're actually pulling back the reins a little bit because we want to make sure that the site, which is on the shores of Lake Michigan, is conducive to making sure it supports a building and a structure like that's being proposed. For those of you who don't know, we're marketing a restaurant with a banquet facility along with an 88-room hotel in one unit on the lakeshore. And again, we haven't crossed all our T's yet and all our dotted all our I's, but one of the big components is to make sure the shoreline is strong enough to withstand a severe weather event and protects the investment of the investors.
Well, you have to worry about that in the wintertime, especially when you get these icy winds blowing out of the north and coming down through here, and those waves that come up there can crash along. You don't want to have the same problems that a lot of businesses tend to have on the coastline from the oceans.
Yeah. The winter, depending on the coldness of the year or how cold it is, could be more or less severe. Once the ice shelf builds, very little impact to the shoreline. But it's those early spring or late fall storms that could really hit you where there's no ice there and the waves make it to shore a little quicker. We've spent some money to strengthen our revetment, and everything appears to be working right now, but we have one area yet that we haven't built up to standards because we're waiting for, of course, what goes there before we can actually finish the design.
Now, how do things stand as far as the timetable of wanting to be able to move those projects along, knowing that you have all this other reinforcement work that you have to do for the area where it's supposed to be built?
Well, once we determine what needs to be built, the projects will probably move forward concurrently. It's really about making the investment and then setting the construction site timetable. All the prep work for the building is going to take quite some time, so it can go on at the same time the revetment work is happening. So we hope that maybe as early as first of the year that we'll have something moving forward. But, you know, in our business, you know, it could be earlier, it could be later.
Whining Mayor Joe Cicero, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We have a chance to talk with Indiana Senator Joe Donnelly about some of the issues, not only from here in Northwest Indiana, but also the rest of the Hoosier State. Senator Donnelly, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, first off, let's take a look here at an update on how the situation is. With a lot of good news have come out of the General Assembly assisting the city of East Chicago, making sure that some of the issues that they face with the contamination of lead and arsenic in some of the neighborhoods is addressed. And what's the latest as far as you know from the federal angle? We know that, of course, that Secretary Pruitt came into the area as well recently to find out for himself what the situation is like.
Well, we're working to have Secretary Carson set up the date for him to come, Ben Carson, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. When he was up for nomination, I met with him and said, you know, I can't vote for you unless you're willing to come to East Chicago with me. And so he readily agreed, said he wanted to be here in East Chicago to see the situation on the ground, to talk to the residents. And so we expect his arrival. We are going to continue to find homes for everyone in Zone 1. That's the zone that was directly above the lead smelter. And in Zones 2 and 3, we're going to work to make sure that all of the contaminated soil is removed, that it's replaced, that everything is back to an appropriate fashion in that way, and to make sure that our residents you know, have the quality of life they expected, where their kids can play in their yards, where they can drink water from their taps, and have the life that they thought when they bought their houses.
I know that some of the concerns that I know the residents had here, and that's why I'm glad that Secretary Carson is going to come to find out and talk more from the HUD agency standpoint, is about finding proper housing. Some residents had concerns, even though they've been getting assistance from the Cook County Housing Authority over in Illinois to find places over there. They still aren't sure that they've got the right homes that they'll feel comfortable and safe in. So I'm sure they're probably looking forward to hearing something more official from the boss at HUD.
Well, we'd rather have them home in Indiana. And home in a place that they're comfortable in, that they like, that they feel safe in. And so that's the goal, is to make sure everybody has their housing situation squared away in a way that that they like.
I understand that you're very pleased with what President Trump issued for an executive order looking into some of the issues that still exist around steel imports. Tell us about that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we're a big steel manufacturer in Northwest Indiana, probably the largest in the United States. And my job is to fight for our people and our country. And China and India and other countries have been dumping steel in our nation, have been sending steel in at a lower price. And we want to fight back and make sure that that our steelmakers are on an even playing field. President Trump, with his executive order, is looking into all of this, and I support that. Look, you know, when the president does something that makes sense, count me in every single time. When it doesn't make sense, I'll pass. But when it does, I'm right there with them.
I also, too, know lately that you mentioned that about $11 million is coming back to Indiana from Washington to help address our very serious opioid crisis. Tell us a little bit about that, where the funds are coming from.
The funds are coming from the 21st Century Cures Act, which I helped sponsor and pass. And the funds are designed to help local law enforcement, help EMS, help communities throughout our state dealing with the heroin and opioid crisis, to help with treatment, to help with purchase of anti-overdose drugs, to make sure that our young people can survive this scourge. That's the whole idea.
Okay. We've always known that you have kept your eye on veterans to make sure that they are well cared for. And I understand lately there have been some efforts that you've been working on, in particular helping Gulf War veterans. Tell us about that, please.
Well, we've been able to get a Gulf War memorial site on the National Mall. We don't have the exact location, mm-hmm. but it's now been approved by the Senate and the House that there will be a memorial on the Mall. And my partner, John Bozeman, Republican from Arkansas, and I worked together on this, and we were able to get this passed through the Senate and through the House. This is going to honor all of those who fought in the Gulf Wars, all of those who lost their lives, protecting and defending our country and our friends and our allies. And it's appropriate and the right thing to do.
Finally, Senator Donnelly, as we speak here on Wednesday morning, we know that Congress is still working hard to come up with the extension of funding to keep the federal government going here after the deadline coming up this weekend here. And I understand that, that one new development, which I think has helped out, I'm sure, in probably moving the efforts along, is, some assurance from the White House that that the border wall is not going to be tacked on to that particular funding. It's going to be probably brought up, what, probably 2018?
Well, we don't know, but it is it looks optimistic and positive for everything to get resolved this weekend for the government to continue to be funded. And I'm a very strong supporter of making sure we have a strong border that works, that protects our nation. But you know, in putting this wall into the middle of this discussion did not lend toward a good conclusion.
Okay. Let me ask about the budget that has already been just proposed, of course, that the Trump administration had put forth to the media and to the public here earlier in his administration. He had talked about making some big changes. What is the status, as far as you know, that you're likely on Capitol Hill to hear more about this budget proposal? Has been any more discussion or any more clues from the White House when that's going to be put out?
Well, I think that this budget is a non-starter for the following reasons. Mm-hmm. It strips out funding for the National Institute for Health, which is working to find a cure for cancer and diabetes and heart disease and multiple sclerosis, one of the most important things we can do. And so I didn't come to Washington to take away the money that would be used to try to find the cure for cancer. It strips money out from the Coast Guard, who is on patrol out in Florida right as we speak, right on the Gulf and through those areas, trying to get drug runners, who is on patrol in the Great Lakes to keep all of us safe as well. And so when we do common sense things in the budget, I'll support it. But when things look completely wrong and completely wrong-headed, I'll pass on those.
Well, Senator Joe Donnelly, thank you very much for spending time to talk with us today. And we'll keep an eye on what happens on Capitol Hill, of course, and hope to hear back from you again soon.
Thanks so much for having me with you today.
This is Financial Literacy Month. It's a time that's dedicated to highlighting the importance of financial literacy in the hopes that Americans will set up and maintain some very healthy financial habits. And we have to talk about it. Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Haber with us once again. And I guess this is a good time for Northwest Indiana residents to take a look at their own real serious financial literacy, isn't it, Greg? And I guess some of us need some help. And there have been some studies that have been out that say that only, 37% of Americans could pass any kind of basic financial knowledge test. Well, what can we do to improve that record and be prepared for whatever comes about us financially?
Well, I think the big opportunity, Chris, is people just becoming more aware of what opportunities are out there and some of the things that they're doing currently. And that's what's nice just about having the Awareness Month is it kind of draws your attention to the things that go by and by, you know, by the wayside every day because of our normal routine. So just focusing on some of the things you're doing to strategize, to begin, you know, saving or getting out of debt are things that are going to benefit you.
In fact, I noticed that's one of the things here that I have noted down here that's points that we probably should talk about is getting out of debt. Tell us what's the wise thing to do on that.
Well, I think it's going to be more of a prominent focus now because interest rates, what everybody's telling us, right, is they're going to start rising. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these debt positions have been set on a variable rate, which have been in historic lows. And as this interest rates start to climb, it's going to, you know, it's going to cost more for that leveraged debt. And it's always hard to focus on saving when you have those high interest debts that are going to start, you know, cutting into the whatever results you're getting on the positive side from an investment strategy. So debt's always got to be a focus to get out of.
And we should probably think ahead in case something happens. We don't always plan for emergencies, but it's probably a pretty good idea, eh?
Yeah, usually before we even recommend somebody start saving a program is build up a cash reserves at least 3 to 6 months because if you don't, you know, I always tell them life happens. You know, things are still going to go wrong. Expenses are still going to come up. And if you don't have that emergency reserve, one of two things. You're either going to go back into debt or you're going to pull out of the investment strategies, which, you know, and then the timing, it might not be a good situation to pull it out that particular moment and it could cause you more problems.
Probably not a bad idea to have just a regular savings account, would it? It wouldn't have to necessarily be a real serious interest-bearing one, but just have something there to store that reserve in, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not about making money. It's about being there to avoid the problems that you would have if you didn't have the cash reserves.
Let's take a look at capturing the future here. What are some of the interesting points we should note here about, and we've talked about some of these before, I know, in past conversations, about taking care of your money besides looking to the emergency situation.
Yeah, well, I mean, the future, you have to take control of the things that you're doing currently, because there's a lot of the companies are shifting away from defined benefits. There's very few pensions anymore, and if you don't begin paying yourself now, paying yourself first, as we'd like to phrase it, it's going to be more difficult to save after you go through and you're nearing retirement, when the time horizon isn't going to be on your side, because markets, for the most part, they're going to do what they're going to do. They're going to go up, they're going to go down. But if we have longer time horizons, generally the results are a lot more predictable. And you basically need to focus on, you know, what you're going to contribute, because just planning on Social Security for most families is not going to be enough.
Mm-hmm. We talked in the past year about the importance of individual retirement accounts. And we know that certainly the older you get, you have the opportunity, and many of them, to be able to put even more money in up to the limit, don't you?
Yep, and they got a lot of catch-up provisions right now. The 401ks are the first thing we always have a conversation with. If your company has a 401k, and specifically if they're going to match, you definitely want to take advantage of the match dollars. But one of the nice things about having a structured plan like that, I'm no different. You know, if I don't see the money, there's no way I'm going to spend it. So having that, it creates that discipline to pay yourself first. It comes out automatically from your paycheck, and that's something that you can gradually increase over time to work towards amounts that are going to be beneficial for you. You know, you can do it in $5, $10, $15 a pay period, and over time, it allows you to increase your savings substantially.
You probably should also, too, take care and make sure that maybe if you are involved, for example, in a mutual fund of some sort to try to diversify your portfolio, that might be wise to even look ways to diversify even further, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of people hear diversifying and diversification, what does it mean? Yeah, you diversify within your portfolios, but sometimes the types of investments that are not necessarily correlated directly to the market can be a great way to diversify your money as well.
Now, speaking about money, protecting it's very important, I know, too. What are some things that we probably should do, Greg, that would be wise moves, either certainly individually or as a family, and certainly with the help of a financial advisor?
Well, one of the things that I always like to make my clients aware of is the tax implications in terms of contributions to a qualified plan versus something like a Roth IRA that doesn't necessarily give you the deduction, and take a look at the value added now versus later. So reducing the amount of taxes can definitely increase the dollars that are working for you, but then also on the distribution side of it, considering what taxes what kind of impact it would have when you retire. But then also, as most people are aware, there's a huge awareness in the industry right now, especially with some of the things that are going on with the Department of Labor and the law changes. You know, just understanding the fees that you have and understanding what those fees are, what value they're bringing to either you from a planning aspect or to your portfolio, and make sure the fees are justified. You know, if the fees can be reduced, always be cognitive of less fees. But if you are paying fees, make sure that the value is there in other planning aspects.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer during this Financial Literacy Month. And I know that we've talked about making wise decisions on investments and protecting your investments and protecting your money flow. And it's something probably, too, we should do something, if we haven't done so already, to help protect our family. And that's we hate to think about some of these things, but there would be a time that we're not there and they need the help. Tell us what we should be doing now to be able to protect our family.
Well, there's a couple things, and it's never too young to start. I mean, this is one of the things I do myself. You know, I don't just preach it, but when you go into a simple power of attorney from even a medical standpoint, if something were to happen, but even establishing, you know, limited power of attorneys as you get into an age where you might need help from a child or another family member, or if you don't have a family member, it's even more critical. You know, to help them in the times when decisions may become a little bit more difficult for that individual. And it makes it easier on the kids. You know, if you state your desired wishes, exactly what it is that you want to do in a way of a will or any, put it in writing, you know, it helps the kids with the struggles after, you know, mom and dad can't handle it. You know, more than one child's probably never going to agree on what's the best for mom and dad 100%. So if you can clearly state it, it's going to make it a lot easier on those children.
I know that in case of having a will, it's very important. My wife and I have one to take care of our daughter in the future, if need be. I know of, unfortunately, of family members and in-laws that didn't have wills, and they're dealing with matters now involving in the court system. Luckily, it's not been very painful, but it can be. It can be pretty nasty if you don't plan ahead like that, isn't it?
Absolutely, and you know, the laws have changed so much. There used to be a large need for a trust in the estate planning. And today's laws, especially with the way the estate limitations are, Indiana, they've eliminated the inheritance tax. But there are still some things that you need to do, even if a trust doesn't necessarily fit your particular situation. One specific thing is a simple example. A few years ago, they changed the way that houses can be structured in that you can put a beneficiary on the home. Mm-hmm. And just simply labeling a beneficiary on the home would help eliminate some of the estate hassles for either your executor or your kids, and it avoids that probate process. And those things are going to simplify, and the more you simplify, the less costly they become to the family and the less stressful to the family.
In particular, just one point comes to mind. Say that the husband and wife, getting along in years, they have a child that's still around, maybe because of issues involving health or involving maybe they have developmental problems and the like, but they're still able to do things. You want to take care of them, and that's a good way to be able to at least help keep them in the home if something should happen to you and the spouse.
Absolutely. You know, one we always talk about with, especially if there's a special needs situation, there's a lot of things to consider with the value, what that can do, especially, you know, if they receive money, a lot of times the current benefits that they're receiving could be discontinued and then those assets until they're used or restructured. And, you know, so there's definitely planning that needs to be done in that area if you have a special needs or there's a control situation is the words we use often that would definitely benefit the family as opposed to them just receiving those monies.
Now, Greg, we brought up a lot of points here in our conversation. Is there any place that anybody could go to take a look online or get some other information, maybe get ready to go actually sit down with the financial advisor about some of these matters we've talked about?
Yeah, I was, you know, always getting information ahead of time is advantageous. The challenges, as you know, Chris, out there in the media, there's always two spectrums, right? You got one side and the other side, and it's hard because, you know, people are always going to present the way they feel is in the best interest. But just be careful about blanket statements, you know, things that say, hey, always do it this way or always do it that way. I generally think that those are not going to be advantageous in the exploratory stage because you really need to think in the context of your personal situation. And I think just getting a general understanding of some of the things that they're going to be up against before they sit down with somebody, you know, you don't have to know how to fix the car, but, you know, knowing a little bit about how a car operates and the things you got to do are going to be helpful in the conversation with the mechanic, so to speak.
Well,
and that's where I think most people can gain a lot of confidence when they come in and sit down with an advisor.
We've been talking with financial advisor Greg Hammer here in Northwest Indiana about some more matters involving money as this Financial Literacy Month continues. Thank you, Greg, for the updates and the information, and we'll be back with you to check out on other topics real soon.
No problem, Chris. Thanks again.
And here's Lakeshore Public Radio Sarah Opat with On the Radar in today's segment. Sarah takes you behind the scenes of a popular region restaurant.
The Lighthouse, located on Cedar Lake, is a fine dining 5-star restaurant. The Biz is known for serving immaculate steak, seafood, pastas, and burgers. The chefs are even cooler than the 5-star food. Meet Lighthouse chef Jason Toledo. He has over 18 years of culinary experience. Where did the passion begin with cooking?
The passion began with my mother, actually. She was always, you know, cooking around the household because I didn't grow up the richest person in the world. So she, you know, we didn't go out to eat a lot. So my mother did a lot of cooking around the house and she did a lot of, you know, Puerto Rican cuisine. But, you know, since my stepdad was not a Puerto Rican descent, he was more German and Irish, a little bit Indian, you know, she also had to accommodate with him. So as a result, she would make stuff like macaroni and cheese, you know, fried chicken, mashed potatoes, and, you know, stuff like that. Shepherd's pie, you know, she dabbled in that a few times. But that's where it all kind of all started. Because my dad was more into mechanics. I went that wasn't really my thing.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom, she was more into the cooking. So I kind of took more into what she was into.
The taste of life.
Yeah, the taste, the flavors, you know. And she had a lot of different assorted flavors that you know, she liked to work with a lot, you know, between peppers and different sort of herbs and spices, and she did little things that I learned in culinary school that she didn't even know she was doing, but mm-hmm. I actually found out the proper terminology, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So she was like, she was doing thickening agents called roux, not even knowing what the name of it was. She just knew what she was doing.
Jason always has a few culinary stories up his sleeve. I remember talking to you about in the back kitchen at the Lighthouse. It was something about Hawaiian food. I think you like shared a certain terminology.
Oh yeah. As far as Hawaiian food goes, mm-hmm. I used to date this lady back in culinary school who was Hawaiian, and she taught me a few dishes. One of which was called a peasant dish actually, which is very simple. It's called the moco loco, which is, you know, Spanish for the crazy booger.
That's what you told me. Yeah.
Yeah. And all that is just a bed of rice topped off with a hamburger patty, and then over easy egg, and then covered in beef gravy. And then I guess the reason why they call it that is because when you dive into the beef gravy, and then mix it in with the yolk of the egg, it kind of produces a more, well, booger-like consistency.
What do you personally enjoy about cooking?
Oh, I like the idea of, well, for one, as a kid, I was kind of a pyro. I always like to play with fire anyway, so the idea of me playing with fire on a regular basis, you know, works with me. But outside of that, you know, it also kind of started with that, of course, with my mother, and, you know, like I mentioned before. But also, just, you know, I like to, it also starts to create, you know, get my artsy juices flowing, you mm-hmm. know. You know, when you start also learning how to make different sauces, you start learning how to work with them and how to plate them and not only make them flavorful, but make them look nice whenever you put them on a plate.
So Jason, as a chef, what are a few tips when making dinner?
A lot of the classic plating techniques I've learned was sauce, starch, topped off with a protein, vegetable on the side. You know, you apply by that technique and your dishes will always look good
mm-hmm.
for the most part, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of home cooking do you enjoy?
I love to barbecue a lot. I love to grill outside, and I prefer the charcoal flavor.
mm-hmm.
I mean, although I'll get a gas grill one day, you never know.
So if we can go into a little bit more detail about what your job is as a chef at the Lighthouse Restaurant.
Well, I'm like a lead cook. As a result, I control the flow of the line. That's why, if you ever notice, you'll always see me on the wheel station more often than not. Basically, all lines flow. I delegate who fires what when. Yeah, I make things flow. I keep things right. I make sure that everything goes out timely, everything goes out hot, and everything comes out fresh.
And for those green thumbs out there, here's a few tips for gardening. Like for people that want to grow different types of vegetables or fruit, what would you recommend?
Well, when it comes to making tomato sauces, I recommend the mixture Aroma and the San Marzano blend. The Aroma is the classic traditional tomato that you'll see in the markets more.
Mm-hmm.
But the San Marzano is the less acidic tomato, which has more of a curvier look to it, but it's not as, like, you don't see as commonly in stores. So you'd mostly have to go that yourself, or if you go to, like, specialty Italian restaurants. So if you want to make a good marinara, tomato sauce, San Marzano, Aroma combined. And the mm-hmm. best way to go about that would be to, you know, what they call concasse. Concasse means to remove the skin and the seeds and only keep the bulk. You know, that's one of the things I was always taught.
For those who want to make some homemade tomato sauces.
As far as making sauces go, I recommend using a sweeter tomato if you want to go that route. That way it balances out with the heat. So they have the orange strawberry tomatoes. Those are nice.
Mm-hmm.
And the chocolate pears. I also had seen these ones called the Cherokees. Those are actually made for also good sandwich tomatoes as well. There's all different sorts of tomatoes out there. There's so many. So many.
mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, if you go to your local gardening, you know, markets or whatever, you'd be surprised at the type of breeds that are out there. There's just so many.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, peppers. Serranos are nice. Jalapenos. I find that jalapenos don't have the best flavor. I find they kind of taste a little bit more like dirt.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually, if you use right, you can use a habanero, because the habanero, yes, even though it is one of the hotter peppers, it is actually has a natural sweetness about it, which also makes it, you know, has a natural nice flavor. But if you want to go with the real hot ones, the ghost pepper, yeah, those are pretty gnarly.
I don't practice Santeria. I ain't got no Christmas. gardening isn't only for your grandma or your neighbor, Jerry.
It's great, you know. I mean, it's a good hobby to get into. It's very therapeutic. And saves you money, you know. It's from having to spend money on food in the grocery store. So.
Here's a few tips for people looking to become a chef.
You're in the cooking world, there will always be work. And no matter where you go, people always have to eat.
Thanks for tuning in to On the Radar. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sarah Opeth.
And you can hear more of On the Radar with Sarah Opeth by checking out her podcast page on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Tomorrow, Thursday, it'll be another Reporters Roundtable with reporters checking in on the big Northwest Indiana stories of the week. We hope you'll join us tomorrow for Reporters Roundtable here on Regionally Speaking.